Chapter 14. Haven of History. In books lies the soul of the whole past time, the articulate, audible voice of the past, when the body and material substance of it has altogether vanished like a dream. Thomas Carlyle, the hero as man of letters. After George Washington returned home from the war a private citizen, Mount Vernon became a favorite destination for many travelers. Aware how tiresome visitors could be, Washington's best friends hesitated to write too many letters of introduction. Despite their caution, countless tourists showed up at Mount Vernon without introduction. They proved to be a bother and a burden, but George and Martha Washington graciously extended their hospitality to those who reached their doorstep. The impulse of these visitors is understandable. They simply wanted to meet the most famous man in the nation, the man who had won the war for American freedom. Thomas Mullett, a British merchant traveling through the United States after the war, proved to be an unexpectedly pleasant visitor when he appeared at the threshold of Mount Vernon. Mullett hailed from the Quaker stronghold of Bristol. Like many British Quakers, he had sympathized with the American cause and opposed the conflict. Once the war ended, he crossed the ocean to establish a transatlantic mercantile trade. Before reaching Mount Vernon, Mullett had traversed much of the new nation. Curious to hear about his American travels, Washington invited him into his library for a one-on-one chat. A perceptive man, noted for his judgment, Mullett had met many influential people and made numerous contacts throughout the new nation. Washington asked if he had met anyone qualified to write the history of the Revolutionary War. "I know of one, and one only, competent to the task," Mullett replied. "Who, sir, can that individual be?" Washington asked. "Caesar wrote his own commentaries," Mullett exclaimed, implying, of course, that Washington himself was the only one qualified to undertake the task of writing the war's history. "But, sir," Washington responded, "I know the atrocities committed on both sides have been so great and many that they cannot be faithfully recorded and had better be buried in oblivion." In the coming years, Mullett entertained friends and relatives with this anecdote. He secured a promise from one of them to write it down and preserve Washington's words for posterity. Though now a member of the Church of England, Mullett retained many of his Quaker beliefs and greatly enjoyed General Washington's anti-war message. It took someone who knew war from first-hand experience to understand the magnitude of its atrocities. By no means was Mullett the only person who thought Washington would be the ideal historian of the Revolutionary War. Traveling through the nation after the war's end, David Humphreys met several gentlemen of candor and information, who believed their commander-in-chief should be the one to write the history of the war. Proud of what he had accomplished, Washington no longer wished to dwell on it. Instead, he wanted to return to the life of the gentleman farmer, which he had left voluntarily to fight for his country. Though unwilling to write its history himself, he remained curious about how the Revolutionary War would be remembered. The books he read, the letters he wrote, and the people he met during his first 2 years home from the war all reflect Washington's curiosity about how the story of the American Revolution would be told. His correspondence indicates Washington's mood the winter he came home. The first Sunday in February 1784, he wrote several letters to distant friends, announcing that he had resigned his commission and returned to Mount Vernon. Though these letters express similar sentiments, Washington, like any good letter writer, shaped his message to suit individual correspondents. To the Marquis de Chastellux, for example, he wrote, "I am at length become a private citizen of America on the banks of the Potomac, where under my own vine and my own fig tree, free from the bustle of a camp and the intrigues of a court, I shall view the busy world in the calm lights of mild philosophy, and with that serenity of mind which the soldier in his pursuit of glory, the statesman of fame, have not time to enjoy. Washington's words present a rich mix of allusions. The dual image of the vine and the fig tree comes from the Old Testament, Micah chapter 4, verse 4. The preceding biblical verse provides its context. And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. In short, Washington's biblical allusion offers a shorthand way to describe a time of peace, plenty, and harmony once war has ended. To enhance the complexity of his allusion, Washington added a literary reference. The phrase he put in quotation marks comes from the first scene of Joseph Addison's Cato. As Porcius and Marcus, Cato's sons, discuss how Caesar has ravaged the land, the hot-headed Marcus admires the steady temper of his brother, who can look on guilt, rebellion, fraud, and Caesar in the calm lights of mild philosophy. Washington used this literary allusion to evoke an image in Shostilukh's mind of an ideal personal space. As Washington foresaw his life, Mount Vernon would become a place of prosperity separated from the world of conflict and political strife, a place where he could enjoy the pleasures that come with being a gentleman farmer. Anxious to make improvements to his plantation, he could do little outdoors this cold and snowy winter. With the river frozen and nearby roads impassable, few visitors and little mail reached Mount Vernon in early 1784. Washington had to wait 6 weeks after returning home from the war before he could announce his retirement to Shostilukh's and other distant correspondents. The harsh winter weather prevented him from sending letters any sooner. As heavy snow blanketed Mount Vernon, he kept busy with indoor improvements, not least of which was organizing his library and finding room to shelve all the books he had bought in New York. By no means was he finished buying books. One of the few pieces of mail he received that winter was a catalog from a new bookshop in Philadelphia, established by Daniel Bourneau and Alexander Gaillard, who specialized in imported French books. Boisneau and Gaillard also stocked some English books, which they listed in the back of their catalog. To put their business on a firm footing, they used some aggressive marketing techniques. Seeking a distinguished American clientele, Boisneau and Gaillard contacted some of the nation's foremost leaders and readers. Besides Washington, they also wrote to Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. The third week of February, Washington acknowledged his receipt of the catalog. What begins as a letter of acknowledgement becomes an eloquent statement regarding the public's responsibility to literature. Washington wrote, "To encourage literature and the arts is a duty which every good citizen owes to his country, and if I could be instrumental in promoting these and in aiding your endeavors to do the like, it would give me pleasure." By cultivating a love of literature, citizens could advance their nation's intellect and contribute to its greatness. Perhaps no one has expressed this idea better than George Washington. To repeat, "To encourage literature and the arts is a duty which every good citizen owes to his country." Since Washington could not read French, the catalog listed few titles that appealed to him. Many of the English authors, Eliza Haywood, Tobias Smollett, Edward Young, he already had in his Mount Vernon library. He managed to find a handful of appealing titles and listed them in his letter to Boisneau and Gaillard. He never received the books he ordered, but the list itself, read in conjunction with the catalog, reveals much about his literary tastes. The order of the titles indicates precisely how he read the catalog. Some works in the English section piqued his curiosity. The titles he requested affirm his interests in biography, history, and travel writing. William Lothian's History of the United Provinces of the Netherlands, for one, shows Washington recognized that knowledge of the Dutch Confederacy could aid the development of the United States. Clearly, he was eager to learn the history of other nations to understand his own. After listing a handful of English titles, he read the catalog a second time, scrutinizing the French section more closely. He did find two basic French works that might prove useful, a grammar and a pocket French-English dictionary. Often during the war, he had wished that he could understand French. Even if he never used these books personally, Wash and Nellie might learn from them. Going through the English section of the catalog a second time, Washington found John Williams's On the Rise, Progress, and Present State of the North Government, a history of several Northern European nations from the Netherlands to Russia. The presence of this title among the books Washington requested further reveals his desire to learn more about how other nations worked. Some titles that caught Washington's eye also attracted Madison's attention. After reading the catalog himself, Madison wrote Jefferson, telling him Boisneau and Gaillard had for sale several items about Dutch, German, and Swiss governments. Madison explained why these books interested him so much. The operation of our own must render all such lights of consequence. Thinking deeply about the shape the United States government would take, Madison sought any and all available information concerning how other governments worked. Washington's attention to the historical accounts of European nations seems differently motivated. Assuming his service to the nation had ended with the war, he was not directly involved in the creation of its new government, at least not yet. He was more interested in reading accounts of other nations to compare their history with that of the United States. How would the history of America be told? Before the story of the Revolutionary War had been written, the military officers who participated in it had found one way to commemorate the conflict. They formed a veterans organization for officers who had fought in the war. In 1783, General Henry Knox had proposed the establishment of a military society whose membership would be open to all officers who had served in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War for 3 years or were serving in the Army at the end of the war. According to Knox's proposal, the organization would also be open to French officers of the rank of colonel and above. Knox and the other founding members of the society chose to name it after Cincinnatus, the Roman general who left his farm to lead the war against the Aequi. Much like their Roman predecessor, many American officers had left their farms at considerable financial sacrifice to serve their country. Knox and the other founding members drafted the institution, as they termed the society's constitution. Before securing Washington's approval, the organizers selected him to preside over the Society of the Cincinnati. Initially, Washington was unsure whether to support the organization. While the Cincinnati promised to benefit American veterans, it possessed potentially dangerous powers. According to the organizers, it would function as a benevolent society, helping former officers in times of need and giving veterans a strong political base, making sure Congress would not ignore them in the future. So far, so good. But the idea of a powerful and well-funded group of military officers fueled American fears of a standing army. Worst of all, a hereditary clause that allowed each member of the society to pass membership to his eldest son reeked of European aristocracy. With these controversial ideas circulating, the organizers of the Cincinnati scheduled its first National Assembly for May 1784. In the months before the meeting, Washington remained skeptical about the Cincinnati. Knox wrote from Boston in February to allay his concerns. He narrowed the objections down to one. The cool, dispassionately sensible men, Knox observed, seem to approve of the institution generally but dislike the hereditary descent. Knox identified a specific source for the opposition. Burke's pamphlet has had its full operation. By Burke's pamphlet, Knox meant Considerations on the Society or Order of Cincinnati, a scathing attack by Idaenis Burke, a justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court. First published in Philadelphia, Burke's pamphlet was reprinted in Connecticut, Rhode Island, and South Carolina, and excerpted in newspapers throughout the nation and across the Atlantic. Washington himself added a copy of the pamphlet to his library at Mount Vernon. Burke argued that the Society of the Cincinnati effectively created an American nobility, or what he called on his pamphlet's title page a class of hereditary patricians. In other words, the organization threatened the very principles Americans had fought and died for during the war, potentially undermining the liberty and happiness of all American citizens. Burke told legislators to put a stop to the society, and for that matter, any organization that dared to establish a European-style social hierarchy. His arguments made Washington all the more skeptical about the Society of the Cincinnati. Unwilling to base his decision solely on what Burke said in this inflammatory pamphlet, Washington sought the advice of Thomas Jefferson, then in Annapolis serving in the Confederation Congress. He sent Jefferson a copy of the institution and mentioned its adverse effects on popular opinion toward the Cincinnati. Jefferson himself was well aware of Burke's considerations. He had been in Philadelphia when the pamphlet first came out, obtained a copy for himself, and heard firsthand the clamor it provoked. He recalled, "The epigraph of Burke's pamphlet was, 'Blow ye the trumpet in Zion.' Its effect corresponded with its epigraph." Burke's clarion call led to heated discussions among lawmakers regarding the potential dangers of the Society of the Cincinnati. Upon receiving Washington's request, Jefferson gave the matter much further thought. While appreciating the officer's desire to maintain wartime friendships, Jefferson feared the Society of the Cincinnati was fraught with dangers that would threaten the fragile republic. Like Burke, Jefferson attacked the hereditary provision. He also thought foreign membership inappropriate. In his view, the Cincinnati blurred the boundary between military and civilian. He feared the powerful organization could subvert the democratic process. Washington agreed to attend the National Assembly of the Cincinnati in Philadelphia, but planned to speak against the institution, urging members to alter it radically. Until they did, he would refuse to lend the society his support. On his way to Philadelphia, Washington stopped by Annapolis, where the Confederation Congress was in session. Mainly, he wanted to speak with Jefferson. They discussed the Society of the Cincinnati at great length. Jefferson suggested the institution could be modified to resolve the dangers it currently posed, but Washington disliked half measures. "No," he exclaimed, "not a fiber of it must be retained. No halfway reformation will suffice. If this thing be bad, it must be totally abolished." Speaking with Jefferson, Washington seemed determined to end the institution altogether. He reached Philadelphia by Tuesday, May 4th, when the National Assembly of the Cincinnati was scheduled to convene. He would address the assembly the following day. Prior to his speech, Washington prepared Observations on the Institution of the Society, a document sternly warning the Cincinnati to mend its ways. Apparently, he backed away from eliminating the institution. Observations reveals Washington's thoroughness. It synthesizes ideas gleaned from Burke's pamphlet, Jefferson's letter, and his conversation with Jefferson. Overall, Washington recommended several changes. He urged the society to strike anything of a political nature in the institution, eliminate the hereditary provision, admit no more honorary members, refuse donations from people who are not U.S. citizens, and abolish general meetings. Washington presented all these ideas in his speech, threatening to withdraw his support if the institution were not revised accordingly. Unless its founders accepted his advice, Washington told them they should put an end to the society altogether. The French had already been informed of the Society of the Cincinnati, and they responded with great enthusiasm. By chance, Pierre Charles L'Enfant reached Philadelphia during the organization's first National Assembly. Coming directly from France, L'Enfant announced to his American friends that the French army officers who had served in the Revolutionary War had already formed their own branch of the Cincinnati and pledged a considerable donation to the American Society. L'Enfant pleased the founders of the Society by his arrival, but his presence put Washington in a quandary. No longer could he threaten either to withdraw from the Society of the Cincinnati, and thus effectively abolishing it, without offending his French friends and allies, the men who had been instrumental in his victory over the British. Instead, Washington compromised, agreeing to work with an appointed committee to revise the institution. He now sought the middle ground. He did not realize how many years it would take to hammer out a solution. While in Philadelphia for the National Assembly of the Cincinnati, Washington also shopped for books. On May 15th, he purchased a copy of Lawrence Stern's fictionalized travel narrative, A Sentimental Journey Through France and Italy. It is difficult to say precisely what motivated Washington to acquire a copy of this book for himself when he did, but it was a popular work in revolutionary America. Charles Lee had subscribed to the first edition, which appeared in 1768, and Thomas Jefferson enjoyed it too. American editions appeared in Boston and Philadelphia. It became a favorite work of the Washingtons. George and Martha had two framed prints illustrating scenes from Stern's Sentimental Journey in their bedchamber. A Sentimental Journey was not the only one of Stern's works in Washington's library. He also owned a copy of Yorick's Sermons and The Beauties of Stern, a collection of memorable quotations from Stern's works published in London by George Kersley, who issued other similar works, a series Washington quite liked. Besides the Stern volume, he also owned copies of The Beauties of the Late Reverend Dr. Isaac Watts and The Beauties of Swift. Organized under several subject headings, The Beauties of Stern presents quotations on such topics as charity, compassion, curiosity, forgiveness, generosity, happiness, justice, mercy, pride, sincerity, and wisdom. Washington read the book carefully and took Stern's words to heart, including an excerpt from Tristram Shandy under the heading Consolation. Before an affliction is digested, consolation ever comes too soon, and after it is digested, it comes too late. There is but a mark between these two, as fine almost as a hair, for a comforter to take aim at. Writing a letter of condolence to a friend whose father had passed away, Washington made use of this quotation. After honoring the memory of his friend's father, Washington wrote, "I can offer nothing which your own reason has not already suggested upon this occasion, and being of Stern's opinion that, before an affliction is digested, consolation comes too soon, and after it is digested, it comes too late, there is but a mark between these two, as fine almost as a hair for a comforter to take aim at. I rarely attempt it, nor shall I add more on this subject to you, as it would only be a renewal of sorrow by recalling afresh to your remembrance things which had better be forgotten." During his spare moments in Philadelphia in 1784, Washington caught up his correspondence. He wrote the Reverend William Gordon, whom he had first met in Cambridge, Massachusetts, during the siege of Boston, and who had continued researching the history of the Revolutionary War throughout its duration, collecting newspaper clippings, interviewing generals and legislators, studying public documents, and reading private papers. With the war's end, Gordon hoped to finalize his research and draft his manuscript. In 1784, he planned a fact-finding tour from his home in Massachusetts to Annapolis. Since Mount Vernon was not too far from Annapolis, Gordon thought he might also see Washington. 2 months earlier, he had written to ask if he could come to Mount Vernon and inspect the collection of papers Washington had amassed throughout the war. The collection of manuscript material deserves consideration as a crucial part of Washington's library. Returning home from the war, he brought a vast amount of personal and professional writings. Some of these writings were already copied into letter books. Others would be copied in the future by Washington's secretaries. Letter books would remain extremely important in the years Washington spent at home. They provided the first draft of outgoing correspondence from Washington to his correspondents. Washington would dictate these letters to his secretaries and then copy the letter, sometimes with a few alterations, and send that version to his correspondents. After he returned home at the end of 1783, Mount Vernon became the single most important archive in the United States outside the papers of the Continental Congress. He spent considerable time organizing this collection of correspondence and papers. Washington understood that the letters he wrote and those he received during the war constituted the primary documents on which any responsible history would be based. He strongly believed that whoever wished to write an authoritative history of the American Revolution would have to read the primary documents thoroughly, as he explained to Gordon from Philadelphia. "No historian can be possessed of sufficient materials to compile a perfect history of the Revolution who has not free access to the archives of Congress, to those of the respective states, to the papers of the Commander-in-Chief, and to those of the officers who have been employed in separate departments." While understanding the historic significance of his own papers, Washington also knew they contained much sensitive information, so he hesitated to share them. Not until Gordon secured congressional approval would Washington grant him access to the documents in his collection. Upon receiving Washington's letter, Gordon petitioned Congress to use both its manuscript holdings and Washington's papers. Congress agreed to open its archives for Gordon and permitted Washington to share his papers with him. Relieved at securing these permissions, Gordon made plans to visit Mount Vernon. When he arrived on Wednesday, June 2, 1784, he showed the written approval from Congress to Washington, who warmly welcomed him to his home and provided full access to his papers, letting him use his discretion in choosing which documents to quote. By securing permission from Congress to access Washington's papers, Gordon enabled other Mount Vernon visitors to enjoy them. When British historian Catherine Macaulay Graham came to Virginia, for example, Washington happily opened up his personal archive for her perusal and amusement. Gordon developed a routine at Mount Vernon. Each morning he rose with the sun and settled himself in the library once it was light enough to read. He continued reading every day until dark, taking time out for meals and occasional conversations with Washington. Gordon boasted that within 3 weeks he had finished his work, having searched and extracted 33 volumes of copied letters of the general, besides 3 volumes of private, 7 volumes of general orders, and bundles upon bundles of letters to the general. Putting up a house guest for several weeks was an inconvenience, of course, but Washington tolerated Gordon's presence because he understood the value of his historical research. Gordon's announcement that he had finished going through all the papers less than 3 weeks after his arrival astonished him. Privately, Washington questioned Gordon's thoroughness. 3 weeks seemed much too short a time for any researcher to have sifted through the documents that had taken the commander of the Continental Army 8 years to assemble. With his research complete, Gordon returned to Massachusetts to draft his manuscript. He kept writing through early 1786, when he was ready to send the book to press. Gordon had sympathized with the American cause throughout the war, but chose to end his days in England. Gordon's acerbic personality created enemies within his Massachusetts congregation and among some of the state's prominent political leaders. He also decided to publish his history in London. Determined to make the work as objective as possible, he concluded that it would be impossible to publish an objective history in the United States. Apparently, it did not occur to Gordon that publishing an impartial account of the Revolutionary War would be no more possible in England than in America. Only after returning to England in 1786 did Gordon realize he could not publish his history as it stood. It was too favorable toward the Americans and too critical of the British. John Adams, then in London serving as American Minister Plenipotentiary to Great Britain, saw the manuscript Gordon originally completed and heard the rumors about how he had changed it. Adams recorded the situation in the margins of his copy of Gordon's history. His marginalia reveal the complexities of history writing and history reading. Having asked some London friends their opinion, Gordon was crestfallen. Adams explained, "These judges were of opinion that the book would not sell if the style was not made more fashionable, if the severity of reflections on the English were not softened, and if the praises of Americans were not moderated. All this was done." Precisely how the manuscript underwent revision remains a mystery. The published version is not divided into chapters. Instead, it is structured as a series of letters written during the war. In the late 18th century, the epistolary format was a fashionable way of presenting both historical information and philosophical ideas. Think of Crèvecoeur's Letters from an American Farmer. Gordon explains in his preface, "The form of letters instead of chapters is not altogether imaginary, as the author, from his arrival in America in 1770, maintained a correspondence with gentlemen in London, Rotterdam, and Paris, answering in general to the prefixed dates." A chronological series of letters, according to Gordon, could create an impression similar to what is felt when a well-executed historical painting is examined. Gordon's remarks reinforce the close association between history writing and history painting in the late 18th century. According to John Adams, however, Gordon's letter format was an afterthought. He had not used it originally. Describing the circumstances of the book's revision, Adams noted, "The form of letters, too, was the effect of booksellers' advice. The original manuscript had it not." Gordon's manuscript does not survive, so the extent of his revision remains conjectural. Adams said the Reverend Dr. Joseph Towers and his son, Joseph Lomas Towers, were largely responsible for the revisions. According to another theory, Gordon let a professional writer recast his manuscript, but became so enraged that he rewrote it himself. The whole process resulted in 3 distinct manuscript versions of the history. Literary historian Moses Coit Tyler surmises that all the revisions badly mutilated Gordon's history. Besides recasting its form, Gordon toned down many expressions, modified numerous factual details, and cut out big chunks of narrative, amounting to perhaps 100 pages. Even with all its changes, Gordon's work remains a vital contribution to the history of the war, based as it is on personal interviews with all the major players in the drama of the American Revolution. In addition to revising the work, Gordon spent much time recruiting subscribers. The four-volume London edition finally appeared in 1788 as The History of the Rise, Progress, and Establishment of the Independence of the United States of America. The first volume includes a list of subscribers. Gordon listed the British and European ones alphabetically, followed by a separate list of American subscribers. Prominent Americans then living in England or Europe appear in the first list. Given its alphabetical arrangement, John Adams's name is the very first one listed. But the ever-vain Adams was still dissatisfied. The list identified him as American Plenipotentiary. Thomas Jefferson, then serving as American Minister Plenipotentiary to the Court of France, is listed as American Ambassador to Paris. Adams queried, "How happened it that Jefferson was an ambassador and the first subscriber only a minister? Of history, how accurate those art!" The list of subscribers helps situate Gordon's history in the political and social contexts of the day. It lists many British men who had been sympathetic to the American cause during the war, including some dissenting ministers who were close friends of Benjamin Franklin and members of his Club of Honest Whigs, Andrew Kippis, Richard Price, and Abraham Rees. Thomas Mullett, the Bristol merchant who had visited Mount Vernon, is also listed among the subscribers. Though Mullett personally knew that Washington would not write the history of the Revolutionary War, he still remained eager to read more on the subject. Gordon listed American subscribers by state. Washington, whose name appears first among the Virginians, subscribed for 2 copies. Most American subscribers came from either Massachusetts or Virginia. The list of Virginia subscribers is fairly substantial, suggesting that Washington had helped Gordon recruit local subscribers. Their correspondence bears out this suggestion. Gordon did not actively recruit subscribers from elsewhere, but a few men from other states did subscribe to the work. Altogether, Gordon had 1,250 copies of his 4-volume history printed, 250 of them on extra fine paper. Besides Washington's 2 subscription copies, Gordon sent him a set printed on the good paper and elegantly bound. Furthermore, Gordon sent Washington the copies for many of the American subscribers. When the books reached Mount Vernon, Washington found a total of 43 sets, amounting to 172 volumes. These included the sets for all the Virginia subscribers, as well as those from New York, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Nova Scotia. Gordon apparently expected Washington to distribute these sets to their subscribers, a considerable burden to place on anyone, let alone the man who would soon be President of the United States. A 3-volume American edition of Gordon's history appeared in 1789. The publisher, a victim of bad timing, asked Washington to subscribe to the American edition soon after those 172 volumes arrived from London. In his response to the American publisher, Washington was curt. "I received your letter of yesterday requesting permission to add my name to your list of subscribers for an American edition of Dr. Gordon's History of the Late Revolution. As I have already several sets of that work, I would wish to decline adding my name as a subscriber for more." From the time he returned home from the war until the end of his life, Washington received many requests to subscribe to new publications. In addition, a steady stream of books flowed to Mount Vernon, not only books Washington ordered or subscribed to, but also books their authors sent as presents. Many helped expand his collection of Americana significantly. Atkinson Bush, a British admirer, presented Washington with city petitions, addresses, and remonstrances. After a touching presentation inscription, Bush wrote a Latin motto meaning, "This hand is hostile to tyrants." A collection of city petitions from the 1770s may seem like an odd book to present to General Washington, but several petitions specifically involved the American Revolution. The petitioners expressed their concerns to the leaders of London. These documents offer a perspective on the American conflict that cannot be found elsewhere. "There can be no doubt," said one reviewer, "that some papers in this collection merit preservation." In September 1784, Washington traveled to Ohio and Kentucky to inspect his lands there and research a route for a possible canal to connect the Potomac with the Ohio. Soon after returning from the trip, he received in the mail a strangely appropriate book, John Filson's Discovery, Settlement, and Present State of Kentucky. The first published history of Kentucky, Filson's book also contains the first published account of the life and adventures of Daniel Boone. Part history, part biography, and part promotional tract, Filson's book sought to encourage settlement in Kentucky. Washington well understood the power Filson's promotional rhetoric could have. In the essay Washington wrote at the end of the journal of his trip to the Ohio Valley, he beautifully summarized the attitude of local residents. "The Western settlers, from my own observation, stand as it were on a pivot. The touch of a feather would almost incline them any way." Given Washington's great love of the land, his appreciation of history, and his enjoyment of wilderness adventure, he should have liked Filson's book, but it came with an impossible request that soured his pleasure. Aware of Washington's familiarity with Kentucky and the Ohio Valley, and hoping to publish a second edition of his book to encourage both settlement and investment in Kentucky, Filson asked Washington to supply whatever information he could about the topography and the natural history of the region. Ideally, Filson suggested, Washington should send the requested information in the form of a detailed letter that could be inserted verbatim into a new edition of his History of Kentucky. Filson, it seems, wanted Washington to do his work for him. Filson had published a map with his first edition, which he published separately as well. The map also functioned as a promotional work. Filson dedicated it to George Washington without his permission, making it look as if Washington had sanctioned the map, which he definitely had not. Washington had been hoping someone would publish a detailed, accurate map of the Ohio Valley, but Filson's map of Kentucky was littered with errors. While thanking him for the book, Washington made clear his attitude toward the map. "It has long been my wish to see an extensive and accurate map of the Western Territory set on foot and amply encouraged, but I would have this work founded upon actual surveys and careful observations. Anything short of these is, in my opinion, not only defective and of little use, but serves as often to mislead as to direct the examiner." Once Washington refused to endorse the work, Filson abandoned his plans for a second edition. If Washington got over his disappointment with Filson's Discovery, Settlement, and Present State of Kentucky, he could have found much to enjoy. Not only did Filson tell the story of Kentucky's past and present state, he looked toward its future, foreseeing what Kentucky would become. And the appended story of Daniel Boone, written by Filson but told in the first-person voice of its hero and based on Filson's interviews with him, offered an exciting tale of backwoods adventure that would take hold of the American imagination and never let go. Imagine George Washington, having recently returned from Kentucky, seated in his library at Mount Vernon reading the adventures of Daniel Boone. Mason Locke Weems, The book-selling biographer who invented the story of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, among other legends, saw similarities between Filson's story of Daniel Boone and Washington's life. Weems borrowed the heroic pattern of Daniel Boone to create his mythic biography of George Washington. After coming home from the war, Washington waited a long time before he visited Belvoir. Even though he was aware it burned down, he hated to see destroyed a place that had meant so much to him in his youth. The last Thursday in January, 1785, a clear, cold day, he finally brought himself to ride over to Belvoir to view the ruins of what had formerly been one of the grandest plantations on the Potomac. Washington told George William Fairfax, its former owner, that Belvoir was now little more than a heap of ruins. Despite how many pleasant hours he had spent here, Washington could scarcely recognize the place after fire destroyed it. Neither could he bear to look upon the ruins very long. He explained to Fairfax, "I was obliged to fly from them, and came home with painful sensations and sorrowing for the contrast." At a time when Washington was thinking deeply about the process of history, the disparity between his memories of Belvoir and its ruinous state reminded him how difficult it could be to make sense of the past in the face of the present. Historians and biographers were not the only ones seeking to record the story of the American Revolution. Portraitists and history painters also recognized the importance of capturing images of revolutionary heroes from life. On April 28, 1785, Robert Edge Pine, an English painter who had immigrated to Philadelphia, came to Mount Vernon. Pine was a tiny little fellow, but Washington makes no mention of his diminutive stature in his diary, describing him solely by his accomplishments. Washington said that Pine was a pretty eminent portrait and historian painter. Perhaps Washington had meant to write history painter, not historian painter, but his term reveals how closely he paralleled the roles of historian and painter. Before he left England, Pine had befriended George William Fairfax, who provided much help when Pine painted America, the most ambitious work he created in England. America was an allegorical piece which depicted heroic virtue presenting liberty to America. When Pine prepared to emigrate, he asked Fairfax for a letter of introduction to George Washington. Fairfax agreed, sending a mezzotint of America with his letter, in which he explained that the figure of heroic virtue was supposed to represent Washington, though it looked nothing like him. Upon settling in Philadelphia in 1784, Pine sought to establish himself as a history painter. Already he was well on his way. The story of his artistic career is filled with superlatives. In October 1784, he had organized an exhibit of his work in Philadelphia, the first artist to give a one-man show in America. In conjunction, Pine published his Descriptive Catalog of Pictures Painted by Robert Edge Pine, the first exhibit catalog published in America. On the recommendation of Francis Hopkinson, Pine came to Mount Vernon. He hoped to paint Washington's portrait from life, which he planned to make part of a projected set of 8 paintings that would record the foremost events of the Revolutionary War. Pine stayed at Mount Vernon for nearly 3 weeks. During that time, he painted Washington's portrait, Martha's, and those of her 4 grandchildren. His personal manner of painting was distinctive. Rembrandt Peale, who had an opportunity to watch him paint, observed, "He seemed to my young mind as a conjurer with his mall stick wand and the rainbow tints of his palette." Pine was not the only distinguished artist to visit Mount Vernon in 1785. The foremost sculptor in Europe, Jean-Antoine Houdon, had agreed to visit the New World to sculpt Washington's head from life as part of his preliminary work for creating a life-size statue of George Washington to stand in the state capitol in Richmond. Thomas Jefferson worked hard to make Houdon's American visit possible, though he characteristically downplayed his own efforts, attributing Houdon's decision to visit the United States solely to the artist's personal motivation. In Jefferson's words, Houdon was so anxious to be the person who should hand down the figure of the general to future ages that without hesitating for a moment he offered to abandon his business here, in Europe, to leave the statues of kings unfinished, and to go to America to take the true figure by actual inspection and measurement. Once Houdon was ready to leave Paris, David Humphreys wrote a letter introducing him to Washington. Humphreys was in Paris serving as secretary to the commission to negotiate treaties of amity and commerce. His letter of introduction expresses his confidence that Houdon would create an excellent likeness of Washington. "Not only the present but future generations will be curious to see your figure taken by such an artist. And indeed, my dear general, it must be a pleasing reflection to you amid the tranquil walks of private life to find that history, poetry, painting, and sculpture will vie with each other in consigning your name to immortality." At Mount Vernon, Houdon made a life mask of Washington, modeled a bust in terracotta, and took his measurements to make the statue as accurate as possible. Houdon returned to his Paris studio to create the statue, which took him around 3 years. Time well spent. Many consider the statue of Washington to be Houdon's masterpiece. In addition, it has been recognized as the most accurate likeness of Washington ever created. Yet it is more than that. Describing Houdon's Washington, art historian Wayne Craven observes, "The details of the clothing are simplified so that they do not demand undue attention in themselves, and the eye of the spectator is continually drawn to the head, which portrays the nobility, the pensiveness, the gentleness, and the calm dignity of the man." Important as a reflection of Houdon's art and Washington's character, the statue would also play a part in the development of American art. Once erected in the Virginia Capitol, Houdon's Washington rapidly encouraged the growth of monumental sculptural art in the United States. When David Humphreys said that poetry was vying with sculpture to depict Washington, he had a specific work in mind. Along with the letter introducing Houdon to Washington, Humphreys included a copy of his latest work, A Poem on the Happiness of America, several pages of which do indeed commemorate Washington. Since Humphreys had been with the general when he resigned his commission in Annapolis, he had heard the eloquent speech Washington had delivered to Congress on that occasion. A Poem on the Happiness of America incorporates a lengthy versification of Washington's speech, rendered into regular heroic couplets. Humphreys belonged to a group of American poets known as the Connecticut Wits, all of whom commemorated the Revolutionary War in their own way. The Reverend Timothy Dwight, another one of the Connecticut Wits, sought to honor Washington with his verse, though not in the way their mutual friend Colonel Henry Babcock had hoped. Babcock, having served as colonel of a regiment at Fort Ticonderoga in 1775, was dismissed as commander of the Rhode Island forces the following year because of what Washington called a distempered mind. In 1784, Babcock wrote his former commander-in-chief to suggest that Dwight could do justice to your matchless achievements, perhaps equal to Alexander Pope, Swift, or Dryden. If Dwight came to Mount Vernon, he could write an epic poem that would be better than any history yet wrote, not excepting Mr. Gordon's History of the American Revolution. It would be read with great avidity throughout the globe. Babcock's letter, which continues in the same vein at some length, shows he remained a little touched in the head. Dwight's poem was neither historical nor biographical, but biblical. He called it The Conquest of Canaan and dedicated it to Washington. Unlike Filson, Dwight secured Washington's permission before dedicating his work to him. Beyond the dedication, The Conquest of Canaan makes no direct mention of Washington, but it is impossible to read the poem and not think of him. Dwight's biblical epic retells the story of Joshua, a powerful military hero who leads the chosen people to victory. Dwight's poem has numerous ties to American history. The portrayal of New England as the New Canaan had been an important part of Puritan literature since the early 17th century. Joshua resembles Washington in terms of both leadership and military prowess. In his footnotes to The Conquest of Canaan, Dwight made the analogy between the biblical story and American history explicit with reference to the heroes of the Revolution. Furthermore, the poem embodies some key concepts that were already a part of early American historiography. Late in the poem, for example, Dwight presents his version of Translatio. In that dread hour, beneath auspicious skies, to nobler bliss yon western world shall rise. Footnoting these lines, Dwight explains what he is talking about: freedom and glory of the North American states. When George Washington came back to Mount Vernon after the war, he was curious about how history would record the story of the American Revolution. His experience at home during the first 2 years after his return taught him that the situation was much more complex. With historians, biographers, painters, sculptors, and poets vying to capture his image and record his story, Washington could see that the process of telling the story of the American Revolution was not merely a matter of recording history. It was a process of making myth.